Hello and welcome. It's another episode of A Cast of Entrepreneurs, and I'll get on to introducing the cast in just a second. But first, I'd like to welcome Sally Cowling, who's with me as always. Good afternoon, Sally.
Hi, Elaine. How are you?
I'm very well and excited to meet this cast. We've brought together Steve Rawlingson. Hi, Steve.
Hello, how are you?
From Samuel Knight International. Excited to find out a little bit more about your business. And next to Steve, we have Claire Rutherford from Definition IP. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Elaine. How are you doing?
I'm very well. And finally, last, we have Richard Lane from Durham Lane.
Hi, Elaine. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Well, thank you for coming into the theatre for this episode of A Cast of Entrepreneurs. As always, we're going to start by asking you a little bit about how you got to where you are today. So my question, and we'll start with Richard, tell us about your motivations and how Durham Lane came about.
Right, okay. So Durham Lane has just turned 13 as a business, so we're now an unruly teenager, is what I'm telling my current customers. I left corporate land 15 years ago, gave them a year's notice, decided that living in the Northeast, I wanted to put some roots down with my corporate company. I was never in the Northeast unless I was, and then I was in a home office and didn't meet anyone really. So left, set up my own business, had a very happy couple of years. Me, built out, selling at a high level, our methodology, won some customers, got into the local region, and then met this guy called Lee Durham and recognised and realised that I wanted to build something. And we set Durham Lane up on the 1st of April 2011.
So tell us, what does Durham Lane actually do?
So Durham Lane is an integrated sales and marketing business. We say that we're tech-enabled but human-powered. So we essentially operate at the front end of our customer sales processes, creating consistent pipelines of well-qualified and meaningful leads, which, you know, is really the lifeblood of every organisation.
Oh, excellent. And we'll delve more into a little bit about what it is to be a 13-year-old and a teenager as we get into this conversation. But firstly, I'll turn to Claire. Now, your business is quite different as a patent attorney. Tell us about when you set up your business and what made you decide to go alone.
So I set up Definition IP just over 8 years ago now, so we're not quite an unruly teenager, we're still in the growth phase. So my background is sort of a patent attorney, takes quite a lot of training to get to qualification. So in the early days, I worked in Glasgow for a relatively small firm, and the guy who ran that firm was very entrepreneurial himself, which is not that common in the legal field or in the field of patent attorneys. So I think I was sort of brought into the business by an entrepreneur. We were then acquired by a much bigger company. So I opened the Newcastle office for the company I worked for. We were acquired by a much bigger corporate. So I got some interesting time working with them as well. So I had a nice balance, but ultimately decided that having worked with a lot of entrepreneurs, maybe it was time to go on my own. So saw an opportunity to work with high growth businesses, technology businesses. My background's life sciences, and took the leap about 8 years ago. First year at my kitchen table, near enough. And then my business partner, Dan, joined me. He's a software specialist, so that gave us a second string to our bow. And then we'll probably come on to it later. Another person I'd worked with before, Emma Sampson, based in Dublin. She's a chemist. So for patent attorneys, that's the holy grail, the holy triumvirate of life sciences, chemistry and engineering. And yeah, so we took it from there and have built up in Newcastle and Dublin.
And did you always think you were going to be an entrepreneur?
No, Claire? I did not see it coming at all. Definitely wasn't built into my family. But a lot of people I speak to who are entrepreneurs have got it in the family. I think my mum and dad were somewhat confused about, well, what a patent attorney was to start with, and continued to be confused when I decided to jump ship into this. I think I confused myself. It was maybe an early midlife crisis. But I thought I'd give it a go. And actually, I think it's, you know, sometimes you just have to go with these things and give them a go.
It sounds like it was meant to be. And Steve, what about your business? Tell us a bit more about Samuel Knight and how that started.
So, been in corporate since 2004. Worked my way up to being one of the youngest managing directors of a FTSE 500 recruitment company. And I could see that the markets that I operated in was evolving quite a lot. And they were kind of like an old school recruitment business. They had their mythologies in terms of how they did things, and that was literally it. It was like, it's not broken, so let's not try and fix it. And I kind of sat there and thought, well, we've got to evolve with the time. And the senior management team were all dinosaurs and they didn't believe in that. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to pretty much sell everything I've got and start up on my own. So that's what I did in March 2014. And Samuel Knight was born in a two-man office in Newcastle. And there was four of us cramped into this little two-man office. They say it was a two-man, but I think the guys were just moaning. It was more like a four-man. It wasn't a broom cupboard. But it was a very small office. And I didn't really think of, had this big audacious plan, like it was going to be this amazing company. If I'm honest, I wanted to work for a business that I felt proud of working for and that could be quite open to change and adaptable to the market sector. And if I'm honest, I genuinely thought I would probably only work with about three or four companies, maybe get the business to 10 staff and it'd be a lifestyle business. But that's not what it turned out to be. So Samuel Knight is a global specialist renewable energy recruitment business and sustainable transportation. We now have offices in Newcastle, London, Bristol, Chicago, Boston, Dallas, and we've just launched in India as well. 100 permanent staff, about 400 temp staff, and essentially we work with independent power producers and we supply them with their senior mid-level engineering expertise up to senior management level. And then we've also got a group, the business is now a group of companies where we also self-perform some of his own work as well. So the business is continually evolving into, yes, we've got the recruitment element, but we've also got the engineering element and then a tech service business that's come live as well. So, yeah.
So it's quite a transformation from your broom cupboard days.
Yeah, but there wasn't a plan to do that. That plan only probably came into place after about maybe 2 years. Yeah, maybe about 2 years. The first 2 years, it was like a struggle. And then, yeah, I kind of thought, actually, I might have something here, so let's just go with it and just see what happens.
And what about the global expansion? Because you mentioned that you're in quite a few different countries. Has that happened naturally because your customers are there, or was it always, was it a strategic plan?
No, it wasn't. But essentially, COVID hit. Our business was very much focused around the EMEA. Obviously, no flights were allowed to leave the country. We were supplying Westerners into the Europe, Middle East and Africa regions. And you could see quite quickly that the business was going to go into freefall. And from my perspective, all I cared about was keeping people in a job. So the only objective that we had was to survive. And for some strange reason, a client had seen a picture that we'd posted 6 months beforehand of me in Atlanta. I was in Atlanta, but I wasn't in Atlanta to do work in the USA, which is his first internationalization part of Samuel Knight. This client phoned me up and said, oh, I didn't realise that you were in America. And I was like, oh, yeah, I was. I was confused with why he actually said, are you in America? I thought you meant me personally, not the business. And I was like, yeah, I was in America, yeah. Oh, right, OK, well, I've got a couple of roles. And he asked for his help and said that he'd put this out to an organisation in the US and they couldn't deliver to it. And they'd had the role for about 3 months. He gave it me and I placed it within 2 weeks and that recruitment fee was like $90,000 for one placement. And I kind of thought, okay, I might have a way through COVID here because I genuinely didn't know how we were going to get through COVID. And I didn't know what I was doing. Never traded in the US. I kind of went along with it and just learnt as I was going on. And within 10 months of trading, the business did $10.7 million in COVID. And I won the Scale Up Award with the Entrepreneurs Forum. And I think people were like, wow, how did you grow by 80% in COVID? And I was just like, I really shouldn't be saying like how I grew, but you know, I was just like, we just went with it. That was literally it. I think there was a little bit of luck there.
And maybe that's the entrepreneurial way. Sometimes you take that little bit of luck and you run with it, don't you?
Yeah, because you define an entrepreneur, and I'm sure it's the same with you guys. Like, I never really class myself as an entrepreneur. But then when you look, what an entrepreneur does is he doesn't think of the risks, he or she doesn't think of the risks associated with doing something. They just go with it and they always are able to spot an opportunity. And I think that maybe that's what makes us entrepreneurs is I just saw an opportunity. And rather than sitting and going, USA, what could go wrong? A lot of things went wrong with launching in the USA, like a lot of things. But a lot of things went right and that business is now a great business. But if I'd have sat and analysed what could go wrong, would I have done it? But I don't know. But I didn't think of what could go wrong. I just went, let's just do it. Let's not think about it. Let's just do it.
And I guess some of the lessons you learnt launching there will have helped you when you've launched into other markets.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. But you don't know what you don't know. So I think one of the things that I've learnt in my 10-year journey is if you don't know something, don't be arrogant. Just ask somebody. Go and find somebody who does know, and they're more than likely to give you the answer.
Richard, is that your attitude? Just go out and find the answers?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I look a bit like you, Steve. I've never labelled myself an entrepreneur. I think sometimes a reluctant one, maybe. Lee, my business partner, is an ultimate entrepreneur, and he wouldn't necessarily use that label either, but he has that drive to mm-hmm. just go out and do stuff. And I'm sort of, I guess, the corporate guy that makes it all happen, and that's why the partnership works. But I am definitely entrepreneurial, as you read the books about other people's journeys and you see the similarities. And I know people that are still in the same corporate job that I proactively left 17 years ago or whatever it was. And I decided that actually I had enough money. I could do this thing for 12 months. My business plan said I'd have my first customer in 6 months. I'll give it a go. And I threw away a lot in that process. That when you look at it, a lot of people just would never have made that leap. But I didn't really think about it. Just
thought, well, exactly the same.
I'm going to do something. It's, you know, life's too short not to give something a go. I want to be near my young family who were growing up. I was in a part of the country that I'm not from, so I want to put some roots down. I remember I wrote to The Guardian and said, do you think it's a good idea? And I got my letter in the paper saying, yeah, go for it. And I thought, well, that's a bit of validation. Let's crack on. I've got that framed in my home study.
Everyone said to me, don't do it.
Yeah, but it's you just, yeah. You know, actually the reality is, I mean, I got my first customer on day 10, so that was great. Yeah. But if I could have gone and got another job. And so maybe that's part of confidence. It's about not worrying about the what ifs, but just going for the forward. It's about looking forward, I think. And I do look forward. So maybe that makes me an entrepreneur, I don't know.
Claire, you're nodding in the middle, so you can resonate with all of this conversation,
I am.
I'm guessing.
Although I partly resonate, so I still don't think of myself as an entrepreneur. It always feels slightly fraudulent because I work with a lot of people who I consider to be real entrepreneurs, sort of inventors and things like that. But also, I do think about all the things that can go wrong and spend a lot of my time just pushing through it anyway with a slight churning sense of, this might not work, but I'm going to just do it anyway. So I wish I could do the thing where you don't think about what can go wrong. I spend a lot of time thinking about what can go wrong, but somehow end up finding myself doing it anyway. So I'm not sure if that is a sensible thing to be doing or not, but at least I can always say I saw it coming when it does go wrong.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think this is quite a big, and again, a bit of a pop psychologist, but a massive generalisation, so there's a caveat. But I think Americans look at life very differently. So if you've been successful in the States, you've generally failed at least once. But they don't see failure in the same way that often we see it in Britain, which is like, oh, well, I failed. I better not do it again because of the impact or because of what people say about me. Whereas actually, it's sort of expected. And how do you learn if you never mess anything up?
Like a step on that
so
growth journey.
Our job, and this is one thing we've tried to really nurture at Durham Lane inside our business, is that everyone's got ideas. Let's just put them out there. Let's give them a go. And you know, Jake, our MD, said to me the other day, he said, what I love about, we've just been doing some interviewing, he said, what I love about Durham Lane is that we've always been empowered to try stuff. You know, the two founders have never said, oh, no, don't do that. It's like, well, if it seems like a good idea, let's go for it.
Yeah, that's the same as Samuel and I. You know, we've done things that some have worked, some have been great, and others haven't.
Yeah.
You know, we launched in Iraq, thinking that was going to be a great idea. We won his first client, didn't get paid, nearly sent us under. And then that was kind of like a lesson learnt. And then the next thing you know, I've got a guy saying, Steve, we've got a project in Libya. Shall we do that? And I'm like, let's do it. But there's loads and loads of things that you as the founder can resonate with, and all the challenges that you've gone through and all the hardship and the sacrifices that you've made. But no one really sees that. They just see your shiny object, don't they? 10 years, 14 years, 7 years, and go, wow, you've got a great business. But they don't realise the sleepless nights, the anxiety, and you know, and the grey hair, and they're sitting there. But you just get through it. I think that's entrepreneurial as well, where you just learn how to weather storms and just go, ah, do you know what? What's the worst that can happen?
Yeah, a certain level of resilience is required, I think.
Definitely. I agree.
So, Richard, you mentioned earlier about ideas coming from your teams. How do you manage that process internally and to kind of keep your entrepreneurial spirit alive amongst everyone else? And is there a process that you go through?
I think that is a challenge. I mean, I vividly remember going from 2 and a bit people to, you know, the 10, 15, 25, the 50. We're about 100 now. We were a bit above. We're now just about around 100. And I think that's a real challenge. I don't think we've always got it right. I think we do our best. We've set up a junior board. So we have our sort of main board of the company, which is, you know, the shareholders, chair, etc. And then we have a junior board. So they get voted on by their peers. We change them around every year. Their job is to come with ideas from the floor and put them forward and do initiatives and stuff like that. So that, and that works well, I think. But it does get harder, I believe, as you get bigger. And I think you're different people as well. So the entrepreneurs, let's use that word, who set up a business aren't necessarily the right people to take a business from 100 to 250. And that's quite an interesting concept, something to think about as a founder as well.
I think it's time as well. The entrepreneur that you were in your first 5 years of business, you mature and become different with your experiences. So later on in that journey, when you're 10 years on, you're a different person because of the different experiences. You might not have the same... Well, your energy levels are different as you mature.
I think it's... I mean, from... I agree, you're not the same as what you are when you start something, because the mindset that you have when you start something is the worst thing that can happen is it goes belly up and I go and get a job. I've got nothing to lose. Then by year five, you're like, actually, I employ people. You know, I do actually have something to lose now, because it's my brand, it's my reputation, it's my business, it's I employ people, you know. But you still have that appetite for risk. And then I agree with what Richard's just said there. I think when you get to like 100, 150 staff, you start sitting and thinking, am I still as risky as what I was in 2014? And I think rather than taking, let's say, crazy risks, you take calculated risks. You still want to grow, and you still need that mindset of what's the worst thing that can happen. Like launching in India. We've never done business in India, but we know that there's a market there, and it's kind of like, let's do it. And I'm like, actually, yeah, you're right. What's the worst thing that can happen? But we know that it's not going to hurt the business. It's not going to create any carnage in the business. So I think you mature, your business matures, you do have something to lose, your risk kind of drops a little bit, your risk appetite drops a little bit, and you start taking calculated risks. The younger people, like the ones who have been in the business, not young in terms of age, but like have not matured with the organisation, they're the ones who are like, oh, I've got this great idea, I think we should do this, and you kind of go, okay, yeah.
But you also, Steve, I'm sure have seen this, you become a different organism, because the people that join you when you're 10 people, they're a tenth of the business. You know, they're 10% of your organisation. It's really, you know, they have to be a certain type of person to join that company. When you're 100 people, then you're, you know, 10 times less of a percentage in terms of that organisation. But and so you perhaps you attract different people, and you've got a different brand, and it's, you know, you're no longer in that sort of startup mode, you're a more established organization. Yeah. And so maybe you attract a different type of person. And so I'm just working all of this out. I'm in it, you know, live and in it. And it's fascinating seeing how, what I love about our business is that it's now got a life of its own. And same for you, is that actually my name's above the door, but actually it's got a life of its own as a company. There are people in there that have built careers as part of our business. There are people that are joining it that are starting their careers in this organisation that is a thing. That still sort of amazes me.
And Claire, your business is a bit smaller than Richard's and
Steve's. Yes.
So from your perspective, how are you retaining that sort of initial entrepreneurial spirit as you've evolved?
So we are a lot smaller. So we're still 10 people. So pretty much what you said, that every voice is still quite a big voice in our company. I mean, realistically, our firm to have a few hundred people would become one of the biggest firms in the UK in our industry. So we are niche in what we do. So we're probably unlikely to go that big. But even that, you know, the first bit, you start to feel the responsibility even at 10, but we still have, I still know all of my staff very well, which gets harder as you get bigger. That's not a bad thing. So I think for us, idea flows from thought to action very quickly still, because we're small enough to move quickly. even if we are a relatively conservative industry in itself. So, yeah, I think we have, you know, we have a staff forum who bring stuff to the fore if they want to, if they have ideas and make changes. So that works quite well. But also on a daily basis, I've probably spoken to most of the people in the firm, so ideas are still moving very quickly.
And how does it work for you? Because you have operations in Newcastle and you've got operations in Dublin, as well. So how does that work for you with having split locations?
We opened our Dublin office 2 years after starting. So it was somebody who I already knew very well. So Emer, my business partner. So we already had a really good working relationship. So we knew we could work together. I think technology makes it all actually really easy. So we speak 3 days a week. There's a sort of a 10-minute, what would be called a stand-up, but, you know, a quick catch-up with everybody in the morning so everybody sees each other. I think technology's made it really easy.
Do you think it's easier post? We were talking just before we came on air about how technology's evolved post-COVID.
Yeah, I mean, post-COVID, it became the norm. Nobody finds it odd anymore that you're having a video call. In fact, a video call will take precedence quite often over a phone call now, I think, certainly. And so you see people face... There's people who, you know, during COVID I didn't meet. We hired people. I never met them in real life until a little while later. So I don't think it slows us down too much, and I think it still flows. I think as we get bigger, that will become more challenging. I think new people joining the business, it's more challenging when you're in different locations to try and build the culture. So maintaining a culture across different offices can be a bit more, it requires more active thought. I don't know whether you found that sort of
I try not controlling. I had this vision that we would all have the same kind of like, the culture in each office would be the same, but people down in London and people down in Bristol, the culture in them offices is completely different than the culture in Newcastle. The values are still alive in the business and all the values are the same, but I did try and control it. And then I thought, actually, do you know what? Like, it's the norm to go out for dinner and have a few wines in London on a Tuesday. None of the guys in Newcastle would go out and have dinner and a wine on a Tuesday. Who's drinking on a Tuesday? And same with Bristol as well. And the work ethic down in the south is completely different from the work ethic in the north.
Is it? That's quite an interesting. In what way is it different in terms
of work
ethic?
I'm not the only person who said that. I remember speaking to Ian Kinnery about this because we were talking about the work ethic in north compared to the south. And he was quite taken back. He was like, wow, okay. He was like, really? You think that's the case? And then we went to the Graham Wiley talk. And Graham Wiley actually said, 10 minutes after I said it, yeah, people down in London are completely different to people up in Newcastle in terms of the way that their work ethic.
You say there's a difference, what would you describe the difference in work ethic to be? Are we more hardworking up here?
Yeah, much more hardworking. Yeah. This isn't a dig to the guys in Samuel Knight down in London, but it's like, it's just the way that it is. The grafters. It's just built in as to graft up in the north. And I think down in the south, again, I think there's an element of entitlement because I'm in London, the salaries are through the roof, the cost of living down there is crazy. And in the north, you don't get any of that. There's no hygiene factors in Samuel Knight, Newcastle. It's kind of like I just come in my job and I work hard, I get paid well, and I work in an amazing office. There's no complaining about little things that just shouldn't really matter in a business.
What about you, Claire? Have you noticed the difference between Newcastle and Dublin?
Probably not so much. I don't even know whether I necessarily see the same. So I've worked in longer hours down south, is what I found. I think people here will stop and have a better work-life balance. When they're at work, they'll work, but they don't. It's not a presence issue in the north. And I find Dublin actually quite similar. We found it relatively easy. We needed to be there for a while to not look like untrustworthy interlopers, which again is probably not entirely unlike the northeast, that you need to be around for a bit to be accepted. So we did need to build that. But from a cultural perspective, they've been accepting, with the slight proviso that Brexit didn't necessarily do us any favours because there was a sudden influx of law firms opening in Ireland. And even though that wasn't our reason and we were there just before, we kind of, there was a risk we were being pulled into that, oh, you're just here to have a empty office
space, a
European presence. But other than that, culturally, I found it work-wise, great.
If you're enjoying the conversations on this podcast, then get involved. The Entrepreneurs Forum is a membership organisation for entrepreneurs based in the northeast of England. You can find out all the details by going to our website, entrepreneursforum.net. And Richard, for you, from a cultural point of view, you've got people working for you outside of the northeast, but you've also got customers. You've mentioned previously Americans are different.
Yes.
How has you been able to grow the business whilst recognising and taking advantage of understanding different cultures?
Yeah, so I have always said that if we were based in Reading, we'd be 4 or 5 times the size. I don't know why, just I think there's, you know, you've got such a big market to go after when you're in the south. That's, you know, you can go after anyone, but you're with a quick train journey to them. COVID removed all the walls for every employer. We embraced that and hired a lot of people that are fully home-based. We've retracted on some of that because we typically, not exclusively, and we look at this always as well, but we've typically hired people more at the beginning of their career, so people that want to get into the world of work, want to get into sales or marketing. If they're 100% based at home, it's really difficult to skill them up appropriately and, you know, in a timely manner. And then you know, not to mention the whole culture thing. So that's been a challenge. We've got great employees that are based fully at home and it works really well. But when we've got people in the office and there's the vibe and people are learning off each other, that tends to work really well. Newcastle is an amazing place in terms of talent as well, or the Northeast in general, because of the universities we've got. So our business is multilingual. So we've got 14 different languages that we cover. All of our work is from the UK, either Newcastle or from people working at home in the UK. But I think last year we created opportunities in 48 countries around the world on behalf of our customers. Some of those customers are in North America. They went to a tender RFP process in North America and chose us, and, you know, an English firm that said that all of our resources are in the UK, but they chose us anyway. That's great. And we have a partner in the States that we use. So it's one of the things I'm most proud of, walking around the office and hearing people speaking different languages. There's one guy who flits between 3 different languages sort of on a single phone call, you know, just things like that just make me smile. So that's an amazing sort of step for us. And we're doing that because for a lot of our American clients, the UK is a springboard into Europe. So if we can offer that service for them, not just here, but into France, into Spain, Germany, Portugal, etc., then, you know, adds a lot of value.
And how do you get your people who are permanently based at home to kind of soak up the Durham Lane culture?
Yeah, it's really hard. And that's really important to us. So we've always been a very social organisation. We've always been, you know, doing trips and nights out and things like that. And if you've got someone in Bournemouth, the thought of them coming up for a Friday night drink is, you know, it's probably not going to work out. We've got a end of year gathering on Friday where we've got people that are coming up to the Northeast for a night out with us, and we do try and do that as many times across the year as we can. But we've embraced tech as everyone has, so our team leaders are in constant contact with people that aren't in the office. We've created blended teams, so, you know, whether you're in the office or whether you're remote doesn't matter, and then you have to drive the values. But it's hard. I think it's hard, you know, if you're a gang of 10 or a gang of 25 or 50 or 100 or 200 in one office together, in one city together, then it's much easier to get that sort of gang mentality going than it is if you're all over the place.
And I think it's hard, isn't it? You've got 100 people coming up for a gathering next week, but finding an event for 100 people that everybody's going to enjoy is a challenge on top of actually physically getting them together.
Yes, that is. And we haven't got everyone coming, and that's probably part of the reality, but we encourage people to come up and to spend a bit of time in the office as well, because some of them have been with us since COVID and haven't actually necessarily been to the office. So, you know, just coming in and seeing that and seeing what it's like and having a day of work and then going out and celebrating is an important thing.
Yeah, celebrating, I think, is really important for entrepreneurs. I think you have enough hard days that you have to celebrate the small number of really good times that you do have along the journey. Tell us about an entrepreneurial high that you've had and how you've celebrated.
Probably raising institutional investment, because we were growing organically and we were at a point where I think we were about 35, 40 staff. And a lot of our working capital gets locked in to projects that we're working on. So we don't actually see that working capital until the project comes to an end. Because you get paid and then it goes back into the project. You get paid and it goes back into the project. And we knew that we wanted to scale and grow the business. This is obviously a year before COVID, so everything was going in the right direction for us. We were kind of like, well, you know, we're on a trajectory. So we're like, look, we need to raise some institutional investment. We weren't sure what kind of investment was going to be because no one had, well, as the CEO and the founder, I hadn't looked at investment before. So we went through a year's process and a lot of mentors were like helping me get to that point of being able to say, yeah, we're going to get a deal here. And then, yeah, we pulled off a deal in January 2018 and I sold 15% of the business and raised just shy of 5.8 million. And that was a big moment. And we celebrated by locking ourselves in an office and getting pissed at 10 o'clock in the morning with the CFO and all the directors. And I remember when I first set the business up, someone bought me a bottle of wine and it was Black Rock and the year was 2014. So it had been sitting in the office and we'd left it there and said, oh, it wasn't like a fancy bottle of wine, but it was like, oh, when something happens in the future, we'll drink the Black Rock. And I've actually got the video of me necking this bottle of Black Rock at 10 o'clock in the morning, like January 2018. And we just sat in the office and was just like, wow.
And you've just celebrated your 10 years as well, haven't you?
We did, yes. That was a nice moment as well.
Good party.
Yeah, that was a good party at Above. They say that it takes 10 years to create a business, and if you reach that 10-year mark, then you're pretty safe. But it's just one of them things, isn't it? I don't think any entrepreneur or any founder will sit there and think, oh, yeah, I can, you know, my business is safe now. I think even if you get to 30 or 40, there's businesses who still run out of cash now at that age. So. But yeah, no, we reached 10 years old and we had a good party with family, friends, and obviously you guys came and that was...
Thank you for the invite.
You're welcome.
And Claire, for you, for Entrepreneurial High, what's the moment that really resonates with you and stands out?
I think actually it's probably at the end of year one when I'd been on my own for a while and then Dan joined me and I'd had this fear of being, you know, he's going to join and then that's another person. So it was the first one. It's like, I'm responsible now for somebody else getting paid. And we had the most amazing first week ever where everything I'd spent about 6 months trying to just get work so it would all land. I mean, you wanted to kill me afterwards, but effectively you joined and then that first week, all of the work landed was one day after the next. It just seemed that everything we did, new client, new client, new client, big client, new client. It's like, great. So it's the least celebratory thing. There was no wine or champagne or anything. We got little mugs printed saying best week ever in our first one. And it was that time where it went from being just me on my own to celebrating a win with the beginning of a team, yeah. Which I hadn't had that for that first year. And it was like, no, we're doing this together. And I think that was like a real drive. I didn't want to be doing it on my own. We're still hitting those highs as well. I like that. We're still on that trajectory where, you know, this month we're going to hit whatever figure it is. And it's like, and I think it gets harder as time goes on to keep celebrating those wins or even recognizing that they are a win. And it is that, you know, we're still seeing that. But that first one where it was like someone to celebrate with was
Do you
was
still really have exciting. The mugs?
Yeah, I do still have the mugs. Yeah.
I'm very glad. I was a bit concerned for these mugs.
No, I still have the mugs. So there's just two of them, which we clink occasionally.
Need to go in a special trophy cabinet.
Exactly. We'll have to pop them in there.
And Richard, what's your moment?
I mean, I was laughing at Steve and I were sitting there just beaming as you're talking about it being like the hustle, you know. And we still try and keep that going, but it is different. And I think you have to. So I think for me, haven't had the big moment like Steve talked about there, got the opposite actually, where we didn't manage to complete. So that was pretty, if we're going to talk about the other side of the coin, then got a sorry tale to tell there for a bit.
That's coming.
So, you know, the bruises. But I think for me, probably the 10-year anniversary was amazing. Well, every anniversary is amazing, but 5, 10, those were cool. And then awards, and particularly awards where it's for work that you've done with your customer and it's been recognised by external bodies. I think that's amazing. That's always amazing. Those real high moments. So they're sort of more everyday moments rather than a big whack. But, you know, they're their call points.
And do you celebrate with your customers or do you just keep it within the team?
Yeah, we do. So award ceremonies, we've taken customers to award ceremonies. We've then won the award and luckily the customer was there. And that was amazing. And that's so good for customer relationships as well. If you I would recommend to anyone, spend time on awards and particularly customer partnership type awards because they just add massive value.
Definitely. Well, you mentioned before, and I think sometimes it's easier, isn't it, to talk about the things that go wrong because they're more front of mind than the wins. But in terms of things that perhaps have gone wrong, what we're interested in is the lessons that we can pass on to others and others that may be listening to this podcast. So if you could tell us about a challenge that's maybe you've had to overcome and what we can take from that.
Right, how long have we got? Well, I'm not going to say too much because it's still ongoing, really, but that's part of the lesson, I guess. But we had quite an ambitious, probably classic entrepreneurial ambition in terms of we're going to do a PE raise and we're going to acquire a business as big as us at the same time. Just coming to a completion just as the economy slipped away at the end of 22. So markets started dropping, funders pulled out. We'd spent a huge amount of time on due diligence, from not just our due diligence, but due diligence of the company we're acquiring. So we were trying to do two things in one rather than just one. Why do one thing when you can do two at the same time, I guess, was the principle. And that was a pretty painful experience. And that's been quite bruising, but it's also been hard for the business because a lot of time and attention was elsewhere. So we've been getting back on tracks. And then the big lesson really is, and, you know, I've always said in sales that nothing is ever wasted. You know, that deal that you never close is not wasted because you've learned stuff and you can put it into another deal with another customer at another point. But we know what we need to track. We know what information we need to really measure. We know what sort of reporting we need to be producing every month so that when we're ready again, we should be ready to go. So that's a sort of a current learning experience.
Yeah, and I think any of those sorts of things, it helps you become more disciplined as an organisation. So you have taken some benefits from that, ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ultimately.
Yeah. And the plan's not changed, so the plan's just got a bit delayed. So, yeah.
And Claire, for you, what have been some of the challenges that you've had to overcome?
It's probably a couple of main ones that come to mind. So one of them is around staffing. I think probably one of the biggest challenges that I found was I should have made decisions more quickly when there was a misfit in the team. And I let things drag on. And it retrospectively, I know it was just a bad fit for the person and the team. It wasn't anything else, but I thought it would fix itself. And particularly in a smaller team, fundamentally that doesn't work. You need to make decisions like that more quickly is, I think, my learning point on that one for myself.
I think that's a good learning lesson to anyone listening, because it's easy to see the good in someone and just to feel like
you keep thinking you can
fix them.
It and it's not them, because they are, you know, they're fine. It's just not, it's a bad fit. And I think that was the bit which I couldn't quite accept. I thought we could make it better, just needed a few more months, just needed a little something, or I just needed to work a bit harder on this thing. And fundamentally it didn't help anyone in the whole team. We just needed to deal with it more quickly. So that would be one learning point. And the other one was, we were a few years ago, for some reason, clearly our turnover, something triggered, and it was the time of, like, there was still quite a lot of buoyancy within the economy, so everyone wanted to buy us. So we were approached by numerous people. And we didn't really want to be bought, but we let ourselves get slightly distracted by the excitement of seeing what it looked like. And we lost time. We lost time on our own growth journey by having discussions that weren't right for us at the time. And again, I think we should have just been more focused on what we wanted and not allow the shiny exciting. And it was flattering, but ultimately, again, it was a complete waste of our time. We shouldn't have let ourselves get so deep into that. So again, it's maybe a lesson to myself, whether it's helpful for anyone else, but keep your eye on what you want rather than being distracted by the, because you've got to sometimes be distracted by shiny things because sometimes they are exciting. But again, I think it was flattering But deep down, we knew we shouldn't have been expending our energy on that. It could have much better been expended on building our business.
I know it's hard, but exit is hard, isn't it? Because you can't always exit at the time that you want to exit.
Yeah.
So when you exit is when somebody wants to buy you at a decent price, and that might not be along with your schedule. So yeah. It is something that you have to think about.
So yeah, I mean, really useful to have gone through it. But fundamentally, I did think we shouldn't have spent so long dragging it out. We, you know, if ever it comes around again and it is the right time, I learned a lot from it.
Good. And Steve, then?
Lessons for me. Definitely hiring. Hire well, fire well. Didn't learn that until I came on the Sula. Hired people, could see that they weren't a great fit, but they had the experience, and it was just they weren't fitting in with the culture and were quite toxic, and I allowed it to stay in the business. And at the point, we were only 25, 30 people. And essentially what these individuals did is they managed getting the ear of a couple of the other good guys that had been with me for a long time and ended up enticing them away from the business. And, you know, that becomes a distraction because my demeanour is quite always positive energy. And I think for a small amount of time, I think my positive outlook on everything where nothing really bothers me because I know how to deal with it, I got consumed. And that took me away from what's really important. And that, look, if people want to leave, let them leave. It's fine. You don't own them. Created, again, wasted time. We've hired some people that you think these are going to be amazing. You know, you go above and beyond your kind of like salary structure. You bring people in on big salaries thinking these guys are going to, you know, they're going to come in and add so much value. And then actually they don't. And I remember someone saying to me, the easiest person to sell to is a good salesperson. And even now, sometimes I sit and I get people like talking to me about all these wonderful things that they can bring to Samuel Knight. And I still sit and go, I've definitely learned from this. So I tend to not get involved in first or second stage interviews until the final.
I'm the same. I just see the good in everyone.
Yeah, same here.
So terrible.
That's exactly what it is.
I think, well, that could work.
Yeah.
But that's to be fair, although I was saying that was a learning lesson, I think that's probably still right, though, because 90% of the time, you know, I've also hired, and they're great, and that you wouldn't have seen it from the CV. Yeah. So you've got to keep looking on the good side.
No,
I mean, if the lesson was suggested that it was not to do that, I would say you still have to take your chances. But if you realise you've totally messed up, just deal with it quickly.
Yeah. And Claire, have you used mentors? You've got business partners, but have you used external mentors?
Not formally. So there's people who I've spoken to over the years. There wasn't really, in my head, it had to be, you know, it doesn't, but I was looking for someone in the industry. So I've spoken to people on ad hoc issues, but haven't had an ongoing mentor. There are a few sort of friends, family friends who I occasionally lean on. But within the industry, there wasn't really anyone who looked like me either. It's a fairly Southern English white male led business. So
you don't necessarily need a mentor that does what you do.
I realise that now.
Yeah.
So I think my business partners in many ways, because there's three of us, we've used it to balance us ourselves out, which can be, it's great sometimes, it slows us down at other times. Like I think.
Yeah, if I think back of my mentors, one had a Formula One, like a racing car business, nothing to do with my business, but an amazing entrepreneur. Another one had a tech company, grew it and exited it for 80 million. Didn't know anything about renewables, but helped me massively throughout my tenure. And the other one's a corporate finance guy. And again, you know, he's not an entrepreneur himself, but he knows what great looks like because his job is to build and structure finance packages for organisations. And when he retired, well, I brought him in as my chairman. I was like, you are unbelievable. I want you as my chairman. A mentor can come in all shapes and forms.
I always think I should. So I think actually some of my clients are probably my closest mentors in that a lot of them run amazing businesses. And I get to see how they do that as part of my role. So I get to sit in on board meetings occasionally and things like that. So I see things from a space that it's not a traditional mentoring, but I do get a lot of knowledge and input from them. Yeah, so any offers I'm open to.
We can definitely help with that at the Entrepreneurs Forum. That would be fine, Claire. We are starting to run out of time, but we've got a couple of final questions just to wrap things up. And the first question is, if you were not running your business, what would you be doing? And I'm coming to Richard because I have a fair idea of what he might say.
Well, I was supposed to be a rock star.
I thought you might say that.
So, But whether I'll do that now, probably, I don't think I would. But yeah, probably playing my guitar somewhere or...
Yeah. Making music.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Claire?
I think I would write. I'd always, quite fancied writing a book, and I still ponder it occasionally. So yeah,
like a fiction?
Yeah.
Story?
Yeah.
Interesting. And Steve?
I'd probably be a new age hippie hiking around the Himalayas. I love hiking. I'd probably be doing something like that. Weird and wonderful, taking risks elsewhere.
I think you'd make a merry little band.
Yes.
A little trio around the Himalayas.
Well, I think that's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for coming in and for being so open with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening. There's absolutely loads of episodes of A Cast of Entrepreneurs, so check out who else has been on the podcast. Give us a listen, like, subscribe, leave us a review, and tune in next time for another exciting edition of A Cast of Entrepreneurs.